This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large for Sunday, July 8th, 2012. I'm Ithi Agnihotri Matholkar.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, a conversation with an author whose recent book made the Huffington Post must-read list, and the history of a small town in Benton County.
But first, we have thousands of Pacific Islanders living in Northwest Arkansas, yet we know a little about them. That's why the Migration Policy Institute, based in Washington, D.C., with financial support from the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation in Little Rock, commissioned a scientific survey. But as one University of Arkansas professor who conducted the survey discovered, interviewing what is a remote tribal community poses a challenge. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The Republic of the Marshall Islands census of 2010 reported slightly more than 53,000 individuals, with an additional 22,000, or one-third, living in the United States territories or stateside. 4,300 live in Arkansas. It started 20 years ago when one man scored a job in a poultry slaughterhouse in Springdale. The pay was good compared to back home. Word spread. The schools were great. And so were the local doctors. Today, islanders are concentrated in various districts in Springdale, primarily the northeastern part of the city, with most living in multi-generational apartments and condos. And that's where Dr. Rafael Jimeno, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Arkansas, spent a month this spring meeting islanders. He recently reported his findings to the multi-agency task force called Gaps in Services to Marshallese at the Washington County Health Department.
It was kind of interesting to go up to people on the street, you know, dressed as a civilian, just holding a simple clipboard.
A Marshallese consulate was set up in Springdale several years ago, but mostly this political scientist spent time with islanders attending their churches, going to community celebrations, and roaming their neighborhoods. He ended up with 120 complete surveys of both men and women to obtain what he calls preliminary data points, sort of baseline information, to expand upon in the future.
As you know, there is increasing awareness of the large number of Marshallese-descended people who are in places like Hawaii, like Arkansas, like California. But there's very little that's actually known outside of the community or outside those organizations that work with the community. The general public tends to lack any awareness of the issues that the community is facing. So, I mean, the purpose of the survey is really to explore what those issues might be.
Like access to health care, their political preferences and educational needs.
With education, what seems to be happening is a lot of people are failing to complete high school in the islands and here in Arkansas, depending on their age when they migrate. But, you know, a lot of people would think that it's a simple matter of going back to school and finishing out your last year or your last 2 years. And of course, come to find out that especially for those who tried to finish high school here in Arkansas, the language barrier actually made their performance, subpar for all of their high school years. And so finishing high school is not a matter of just doing one more year of studies. Sometimes it's three or all 4 years.
Gaps in Services to Marshallese conducted an in-depth health survey several years ago to better assess islanders' medical needs, which in part contributed to the opening of a special Marshallese health clinic in Springdale. But it was not a scientific survey. This one is falling under the rubric of a snowball survey. It's a random survey where one respondent leads you to other respondents. 20% moved here to be with family, 15% for work, nearly 12% for education. One quarter said finding jobs is the biggest challenge, although more than 75% reported working in the poultry industry. Because healthcare providers found that islanders prefer to keep their medical status private, a cultural preference, Dr. Jimeno found few willing to talk about it. Dr. Jimeno discovered among respondents low English proficiency, low rates of high school completion, low rates of preventive health care practices.
I think any study, when you get as nuanced an understanding of a community as possible, you're going to have a way of framing it in either positive or negative terms. And I think, of course, both of these things are true. I mean, this community has some amazing advantages and also some liability. So there are opportunities here and challenges as well. So, I mean, it's great that because of employment and employer-provided health insurance that a lot of people seem to have coverage. What's not so great is that nobody is relying on preventive care or really using that health coverage all that much. And so that needs to be emphasized. You know, you have this coverage for a reason. Use it. I mean, there are still some complaints about the cost, I'm assuming, of co-pays, and that probably keeps some people away. But I think for the most part, I mean, there are other reasons that are guiding these decisions, right? And it's probably just a lack of awareness of the importance of preventive care. So that's one thing. As far as high school, I mean, there was a large proportion of the respondents that finished high school, which is great. But there was also a significant percentage, I think it was around 35%, that hadn't even finished high school. And for these people, employment opportunities are going to be limited. And so I understand, as I spoke with you earlier, that there are reasons that many of them can't go back and finish a high school education. But there's got to be something that organizations or the community can do to increase GED taking or GED testing.
Dr. Jimeno found that 98% of respondents were not American citizens, primarily because Islanders may travel to the United States to work and live as migrants under a compact of free association between our government and theirs. But he also discovered that Islanders have no formal path to citizenship under U.S. law. And while the Republic of the Marshall Islands operates as a very engaged democracy, he found low levels of political involvement.
They either asked for a definition and then immediately knew which one applied to them, or they told you outright why they believed they were conservative or why they believed they were liberal, and they used those correctly. I mean, whenever somebody said, "I am conservative," it was because they went to church or because they believed in traditional family values. And whenever they said liberal, it was because they wanted personal freedoms. They wanted to live their life and let others live their lives according to whatever made them happy, as long as nobody was breaking any rules. And so it was interesting. I mean, it was the minority, but those people who employed ideological labels knew why they were using them.
But what struck Dr. Rafael Jimeno most about Ozark Islanders?
I was struck at almost every turn by the different answers I was receiving. But I guess if I had to summarize it, I would go a little bit away from the data points and say that I was most struck by the kindness. I mean, like I've mentioned before, this was a population that had absolutely no reason to participate in this survey, no reason to trust that I was actually going to be an objective observer, and yet they took a chance and let me in and allowed me to be at their cultural events and to be in their neighborhood and you know, accepted participating in the survey. And it was remarkable. I mean, I definitely went into it believing that that was going to happen, but I could have very easily fallen on my face and had nobody participate. And so I was very happy that that's not the way things turned out.
Dr. Rafael Jimeno's findings will be published in a new 3-volume report issued by the Migration Policy Institute on the social conditions and economic impact of immigrants in Arkansas to help improve public policy practices towards immigrants and Pacific Islander migrants. The report will be issued next fall. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Next month, First United Methodist Church in Springdale will host a community block party. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums has this report.
The church, located downtown in Springdale, is in the middle of a diverse neighborhood populated with Arkansas natives as well as people who've moved to the city from around the country, from Central and South America, the Marshall Islands, and elsewhere. The annual gathering serves as a really, really big block party. Jeannie Smith, a co-chair of the committee that puts the church's 2-hour event together, says there are the traditional attractions, games, food, live music, but also opportunities like immunizations for children.
The health department will have a table there. And so if there are parents who have not gotten their immunizations, they can actually get them at this event and get a printout to bring to school. And that's something that we want to do, along with the backpacks, to help families prepare for school.
The preparation for school, the block party is held in mid-August, is a key component behind the event. More than 1,000 backpacks filled with school supplies will be available for children. The church has a partnership with Eastport, a manufacturer of backpacks, to make them available. Jeannie Smith says members of the church's congregation have been slowly filling those backpacks up.
And each week, we've had different school supplies that the congregation could bring and drop off, whether it be rulers or glue. And so we're really looking for as many backpacks that we can get. We have a partnership with Lee Elementary, and we have a partnership with ALE. So we have a number of uses for these backpacks.
The backpacks are why organizers are talking about the block party now, weeks before it actually takes place. They hope to have another 1,000 donated packs ready to hand out on August 12th. Last year, organizers had about 500, and those backpacks went fast. They're expecting about 2,000 people at this year's community block party. Rob Williams is a pastor at the church.
We had to turn away a lot of kids last year who showed up with expectation. We ran out, and hundreds of kids were sent home without backpacks.
Shelley Lumpkin, a congregant and person organizing the children's activities at the August event, says the block party is a continuation of summer activities undertaken by the church. Since the end of the traditional school year, about 200 young members of the church have been involved in local mission projects.
A lot of churches go out of town to do their mission projects, but we decided that we have a great need in our community, so we do our mission locally. Wheelchair ramps, painting, putting up walls, you know, whatever the community needs, we try to help with that locally.
Jeannie Smith, a co-chair of the block party, says there's one more draw for families to attend: haircuts.
And we have some of the best stylists in Springdale, and we could use more stylists. And they give the kids really cool, trendy styles. That was the most fun last year. We had a ball seeing the kids get haircuts.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have loved that. I know when I was in school, we were talking about this on the way over. You know, my mom would cut my bangs before school started. So I would have been just like some of these kids that got a really cool hairstyle the day before school started. So it's just a great, fun time.
The Community Block Party, hosted by the First United Methodist Church in Springdale, is August 12th. It will take place from 5 until 7 and is open to all of Springdale. One need not be a resident of the immediate neighborhood nor a member of the church. And the backpack giveaway that day is at 4. You can learn more about the events at the church's website, fumcwired.com. In the remaining weeks, organizers will continue to solicit for backpack and school supply donations from the community. And on August 12th, Rob Williams, a pastor at the church, says the plan is to have families from the same town sit down together and meet each other.
Break bread with our neighbors to get together and really get to know each other, to take people to the next step of understanding each other.
Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums filed that report earlier this week. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Megan Bergman's new book of short stories has been receiving a lot of attention. Just last week, the Huffington Post called the book a must-read for the summer. Ozarks at Large's Katie Hendrickson recently spoke with Bergman. Here is that conversation.
The debut short story collection from Megan Mayhew Bergman is called Birds of a Lesser Paradise. Now for a debut, it's gotten a lot of attention, including picks as Barnes & Noble, Discover Great New Writers, an Amazon Top 10, and an Indie Next pick, as well as a starred review in Publishers Weekly and a selection from O Magazine as a must-read. Bergman, who grew up in rural North Carolina, now lives in a small farm in Vermont with her veterinarian husband and her two daughters, as well as many animals. The characters in her stories are all strong female characters, mostly in rural settings. And so the first thing I asked her was whether that was an intention from the beginning.
Yeah, not at first. I mean, I with the protagonists, I did want strong first-person female narrators because it was a hard time in my life, and so I think I was taking some sort of respite in my fiction or interested in the idea of women who sort of confront difficulty and build themselves back up, or even women who had sort of taken feminism for granted and then found themselves married or with children and confronting these challenges in a real way when they'd only confronted them philosophically before. So I think sort of tough, you know, feminist women that strive to be competent, still coming to grips with, you know, these very real issues about motherhood and marriage and building a life perhaps in a rural place in a bad economy. Those things all really interested me. As far as the human-animal bond goes, that was accidental, and I think more of an obsession that kept cropping up in the stories. Very autobiographical, I guess. My husband's a veterinarian, and we live on a small farm in Vermont, and we have 4 dogs and 6 chickens and 2 goats and a horse and a goldfish and 4 cats. And I'm surrounded by animals, and I'm also surrounded by a husband and a father-in-law as veterinarians who are helping people make decisions about their animals, whether it's whether to euthanize the animal or how much money to pour into, say, chemotherapy for a dog who's already 10 years old. I mean, these really tough decisions that people face, especially in a rural place. I was just intrigued by what our care of animals says about us, what our priorities are, what we feel for them. All of those things were very real for me at the time and so found their way into the stories.
Birds of a Lesser Paradise actually takes its name from a story in the book, which features a father and daughter who live on a swamp in North Carolina and give bird tours for a living. So I was curious about the bird theme.
Yeah, that's also a more recent obsession. When we moved to Vermont, I found myself noticing birds for the first time. It wasn't that I hadn't noticed them when I was living in North Carolina, but I was really seeing them and hearing them, and they were at the feeder, and I was seeing different bird life. There were more pileated woodpeckers, for example, in and around my house, and so I started looking up Sibley bird guides, and I read a book called Hope is a Thing with Feathers, which is a line from an Emily Dickinson poem, and it was about all of the bird species in North America that have vanished in the 20th century pretty much because of human need or desire, such as the hat industry or people feeling that the birds were picking off their crops. But anyway, it's one of those relationships, I think, people and animals and the choices we make, and also ties back to human exceptionalism, which really interests me, this idea that many humans, I think, forget that we're actually part of the animal kingdom and act accordingly. And surprisingly, that's one of the more controversial aspects of the book or things that I've mentioned in interviews. I've actually had some surprisingly negative feedback about human exceptionalism, and it's funny to me that some people really find it something to argue with that humans are actually part of the animal kingdom, because biologically and scientifically we very much are. You know, we're mammals and primates, and so that fascinates me, and that sort of tension.
Although Bergman's stories are nearly all set in rural environments, she neither romanticizes nor degrades those settings.
You can tell when I read your book that you've experienced these communities and you're not just like either romanticizing them or kind of mocking them in a sense.
No, you're right. I mean, those are the two risks, really, when working with a rural place, that you're either going to sentimentalize it or make it too easy and too romantic and too dewy and too 1950s good neighbory, or you're going to mock it and think everyone's backwoods. And what I've really found living in small town Vermont is that, you know, there are definitely a group of people here that are under a lot of economic pressure and are struggling and have, you know, not really left town ever. But then there's also another group of people living here intentionally, sort of forming this sort of intentional community. I'm thinking about conversations I've recently had with Lauren Groff about her book Arcadia, which takes place on a commune, and I'm not really going to that level of intentionality, but this idea that people choose a lifestyle that they think more accurately reflects their preferences and their beliefs. And, you know, in small-town Vermont, again, there is a lot of economic pressure. There aren't a lot of jobs. The hurricane hit Vermont, southern Vermont, where I live, very, very hard. But there's a great sense of community, of gardening, of sort of bartering and exchange. And it's a really physical life. I just feel like people are outside here, and there's just a sort of reality to it. You can't hide behind your computer as effectively here, and nor do I think most people here want to, and that all sort of excites me and reminds me of the town I grew up in, Rocky Mount, North Carolina, that was a very small tobacco town. I really am interested in agricultural communities. They're very unique pressures there and unique personality types that seem to inhabit them. One thing that my editor said about my book is she summarized it as saying it's interested in the way the pull of biology on our modern lives, and I love that idea. Again, just this reminder that we are physical beings, we are animals, and there are things, be it childbearing or, you know, having contact with our own food, making our own things, that I think might be a little bit more deeply satisfying, even biologically satisfying or culturally satisfying in a way that our digital world is not. And believe me, I'm not trying to be prescriptive or haughty here. I spend a lot of time on Facebook.
The first story, the last line is a killer. But I know the truth now, what maniacs we are, sick with love, all of us. Now tell me, when you're working on a story, especially maybe this story in particular, how do you know how to end a story?
Yeah, I think that's when that sort of second sense as a writer comes in, where you feel your way to it and you read it over 100 times. And if you can't imagine pushing it further and it stays with you the right way. And yeah, I recently attended a lecture by Rebecca Mackay, who's a fiction writer, about endings, and she categorized all the different ways you can end a story, which fascinated me because I've never thought through it scientifically, I guess. I just sort of found my way to it. And this line, when I got to it, I just knew it was the right one. You know, I struggled with it's a little bit of an epiphany, which is, can often be a sort of gimmicky way
right,
to end a
sure.
story. But to me, it just felt right, and I get so much feedback on that last line. I still, every now and then, when I read it out loud, my voice will catch when I read it, and I'll want to sob.
Mm-hmm.
And I think crying at your own story is worse than laughing at your own joke, probably, but I do love that line.
Birds of a Lesser Paradise comes out this summer in paperback. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Mathokar.
And I'm Christina Thomas. This summer, I've been filing a series of reports on a farm-to-school program taking place in Fayetteville. For my latest story, I visited with cafeteria workers to see how they turn the fresh produce into meals for the kids. Here is my report. Cars pull up behind Owl Creek School on a warm and sunny Monday morning. Children hop out, some escorted by parents. They run into the building. Then a large white van pulls up, but there are no kids inside. Vicky with NWA Natural Produce is hauling vegetables to feed these children.
What do you have today?
I have bell pepper and tomato, cherry, and okra.
Awesome.
Yes.
Sammy Jones is the Energy Corps member with Fayetteville Public Schools. She's there this morning to meet Vicky, to help weigh her produce and to make sure she gets paid. Sammy acts as a liaison between Fayetteville Public Schools and the farmers. They unload large gray plastic tubs filled with the produce. Once inside the cafeteria kitchen, Sammy helps to weigh the foods, carefully writing down the amounts. The price per pound is already set, and they have a general idea what they can pay per serving. Using a tool developed by Oklahoma's farm-to-school program, Sammy calculates how much Vicky is owed.
You just type in the number of servings that you know you're going to have, and they have two different serving sizes, and then it tells you the number of pounds you need for, you know, that number of servings or that serving size, and then you can type in the price per pound, and it'll give you a price per serving size. So we're aiming for about 40 cents per servings of vegetables and fruit. So that, you know, we can look at, like, okay, well, like the cherry tomatoes are a little more expensive, but we can weigh that out with something that's a little bit cheaper. So that tool has been, like, I use it on a daily basis looking at this stuff. It's really useful. So
it takes a little bit to pay the farmers. The invoice has to go through the food services office and onto the business office. This is one of the drawbacks of participating in farm-to-school programs for the farmers. Though schools can and will pay their bills, it takes a while. And a lot of farmers are used to being paid immediately, like at a farmer's market.
So there's 4 or 5.5 pounds. Yeah.
Also inside the cafeteria, helping to weigh the veggies, is Tina Bolin, Owl Creek cafeteria manager. She takes us through what she plans to do with the foods brought in today.
This we put out fresh a lot because the kids like cucumbers fresh. I doubt we pickle any of them because they eat them so well fresh. These, they're eating them really well fresh too. And actually, I have some portioned. We'll go look at them.
She's talking about the cherry tomatoes, portioned with about 8 in a plastic cup. Some things the kids have trouble grabbing. Putting them in cups makes the tomatoes easier to grab and go. They offer foods to the kids rather than serve them. Tina says that they are choosing the fresh fruits and veggies, but she is also around to answer any questions the kids may have.
Yeah, and if I hear a comment like, what is this? You know, I always make sure I take time to go explain to the child what that is, because I've heard them before. What is cantaloupe? You know, what is cantaloupe? All kids should know what cantaloupe is. Every mother or, you know, every parent should have fed their child cantaloupe by now, you know.
Cantaloupe, a melon with orange-colored flesh. Tina continues explaining what she's going to do with the rest of today's delivery.
Bell peppers, we cook those in things like Sloppy Joe's, and we probably don't have that on the summer menu, but we'll put a lot of it out fresh. So a lot of this stuff we're adding out is just a bunch of fresh stuff that, you know, that the kids don't get introduced to as a lunchtime menu, you know. And then like the green beans are on the menu today. We're steaming those with a little bit of onions, a little dash of salt in there. Because a lot of our children hear Arabic, so we don't add ham base. So we add just a little touch of salt, because when you take salt out, you have to add salt back. And then we're going to do the pickled okra. We're going to try that like a refrigerator pickle. Instead of canning it in jars, we're going to steam bath it and all that, and then get it cooled off and get it in the refrigerator, and then it'll be just like a cold pickled okra. This will slice out for hamburgers and all kinds of sandwiches that we do in the summer program.
This is the first year that Tina has been in charge of the summer feeding program, a program that feeds kids in various summer camps, but is also open to the public. Any child can come here and eat for free. It is also the first year for farm to school. Tina would like to better pair food in the future, rather than serving pickled okra with, say, a corn dog. But it will take more planning. She has to follow the menus the district manager sets. Right now, what they do is add a fruit and a veggie to the menu that you see printed in the newspaper.
This is all extra on top of the menu. So we already base our requirements on what we feed them already, their meats, their breads, their fruits, their vegetables. But this is giving them a bigger, broad spectrum of fresh fruits and vegetables that we can't normally afford, you know. So instead of peaches and apples and bananas all the time, they're getting blackberries and, you know, squash and cherry tomatoes and things that cost a lot of money. So.
As she stands there, sweat forming on her brow, she agrees that it is extra work, but work she doesn't mind doing.
I'm a farm girl, so I like to feed the kids good stuff, you know, and I don't like to see all this pre-prepared food. That's what I call it, pre-prepared food. It's like my pizza, corn dogs and stuff, you know. Get away from that. Get them a little more real food in here that it's good home cooking, you know.
She takes me out back to a garden that is managed by Sammy and the Healthy Kids Club.
Sammy's already out here working.
She is. Watering.
Let's see, like, well, I'm probably going to have to come get some of this dill to do my recipe for my,
Please come get some of this.
I'm going to, because I didn't know you had dill out here.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like,
that's
Adam.
Taking over.
Tina will use the dill for her pickled okra. Though they can't keep up with the amount of vegetables needed to feed the kids, they can grow enough herbs.
Yeah, but see, like all the spices. And then we'll take these in, and the healthy cooking class will dry them. And we've got some dried up in the back to where they tie them in little bundles, and then we use them. Because spices are very expensive. You know, so you've got to get them how you can. And it's cheap to do this way.
We walk back inside the kitchen, and Tina takes me over to Miss Linda, who has had her back to the room all morning, carefully chopping up some of the fresh veggies.
What are you making today?
I'm just making a salad mixed with some fresh lettuce and some radishes and cabbage, zucchini squash, yellow squash, and tomatoes, little cherry tomatoes.
And all of it is from the local garden?
Yes, it is.
Do you think it's important for the kids to eat fresh food?
Yes, I do. Just like everybody, kids eat with their eyes, and when it looks pretty and colorful, they're going to at least try it.
Yeah. Is this a little bit more work than what you're used to doing?
It is a little bit more work, but it's not, you know, it's, I think it's, the benefits are worth it.
And for lunch today?
We're having cheesy nachos with green beans, applesauce, and we're having cherry tomatoes. She's whipping us up a big old fresh salad from all of those greens and everything that's been brought in. And we'll probably just slice some random cucumbers and stuff like that, you know, just
for so Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
It's Sunday, July 8th, 2012. This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Matholkar, and with me in the studio is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
It's a lot more fun to be here in person.
Yes.
As much as I love New Orleans. Nice to see you.
Yes.
So here's the exciting news from University Theater.
Okay.
Everybody's announcing their seasons. This is the 62nd year for theater at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville.
Wow.
And talk about classics. They're doing A Streetcar Named Desire.
Okay.
They're doing Blithe Spirit, a comedy that was nominated for the 1947 Hugo. And they're doing Moises Kaufman's 33 Variations, which was nominated for 5 Tonys in 2009. And the musical was the last surprise.
Okay.
They thought they had a show. They couldn't get the rights to the show. They had to choose a show. And they couldn't have done better. Company by Stephen Sondheim.
All right.
A modern musical classic, 6 Tony Awards, songs like The Ladies Who Lunch, Being Alive, and Side by Side by Side. It's going to be a great year. I didn't know until I was in New Orleans this time why it's A Streetcar Named Desire.
Tell me more.
Because
please.
It used to be, the area of New Orleans used to be Desiree. And when they Americanized, it became Desire.
That's interesting.
So now we know. Also this afternoon, by the way, season tickets for University Theater will be on sale around September 1st. And if you just can't wait to talk to somebody about it, you can call 575-3946.
Okay.
Now, coming up this afternoon, there's a documentary screening at 2 o'clock at the Fayetteville Public Library called Lioness. It is not about critters. It's about being a woman in the workplace and in the world.
I should watch this.
Crafts on the Square happens this afternoon from 2 to 4 at Spark Cafe in Bentonville. Today's project is paper plate portholes.
Okay.
Sounds like fun to me. An opera in the Ozarks performs at 4 o'clock at the Arend Art Center in Bentonville. Today's opera is La Boheme, and tickets are $20.
All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is the Features Editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. The book, The History of Sulphur Springs, 1890 to 2012, recently had its second edition published. The first edition covered the town's history from 1890 to 1990 and was organized by the museum and 82-year-old Lil Buckley, a self-described town historian. Ozarks at Large's John Schlois recently visited with Lil at the town's museum, where she shared some stories from Sulphur Springs history.
So tell me about some of the landmarks in Sulphur Springs. Like, you have a hotel, right, that's kind of famous?
Well, yes, there is the whole hotel up here. It's Shiloh now. It was a Kilberg Hotel, the first hotel that was built here in 1910, and it was 5 stories high. It was very unique. It was built for the elaborate. It was not for just normal people.
So was it for Sulphur Springs residents, or was it for, like, people from out of town?
It was more for people out of town.
That had money?
That had money, yes. It had a ballroom, and they had big dances there. There were celebrities that came here and stayed there. It had its own elevator, and it was very well run. And at one time then, in 1920, John Brown bought it, and he had a military school there. And then when he did away with this military school, he just had a regular college there and high school. And his mother had a grade school there, and he had what he called Camp Buddy. And then in 1940, it burned. It caught fire and burned, and they only restored the two bottom layers. They did not restore all five. But when it was in its first stages, it had a tower that you could go up in, and you could look into all three states.
How long have you lived in Sulphur Springs?
My husband was born and raised here. I have lived here about 40 years. We came here after we had lived in Illinois for 25 years, so I'm not really a native.
Okay, what about the John Brown University? You mentioned that kind of briefly. I mean, the school that he started eventually became the university that's now located in Salem Springs, is that right?
Yes, but when he left here, he went to California before he did that in Salem Springs. Yes, it is the same John Brown that has the university there. We also had a big bank robbery here in 1925, and it was the fourth time that it had been robbed, and robbed twice by the same man. Birchfield is the one that robbed it in 1925, and he had robbed it previously in 1920 and had been jailed, but he broke out of jail, and then he came back. And
well, his name was Birchfield?
Yes, Birchfield. There was four of them, and there was one man that lived here that was killed in the bank robbery.
Was Birchfield ever caught? Or
yes, he was, and tried. And
do you know the story about how he was caught and tried? Was it here, or was it?
Well, he wasn't caught right away. It was a few weeks later after the robbery that he was caught. There was two men that were injured, and they were caught fairly quickly and put in prison. But Mr. Birchfield escaped for a while before he was caught. But he did go to trial and was incarcerated.
Well, tell me about the name of Sulphur Springs. Do you know the meaning of that name?
Yes, Mr. Hibbler, who started the town, came through here on vacation with his father. They were going to Shreveport, Louisiana, and he fell in love with the valley, and he convinced his father to buy 40 acres here. Out here in the park, there was a huge lake, and after purchasing the land, they decided to probe and see where the water was coming from, and they found four different springs down there. And they're all different waters. The first one was alkaline water, and then there was a sulfur water, white sulfur water, and then there was an iron spring, and then there was a black sulfur spring. They were all just within a few feet of each other, and that's what had fed the lake. So they drained the lake and set the springs up to and had him tested, and he decided to call his town Sulphur Springs, and he began to get investors to come in and invest money and start businesses and such. So that's how the town got its name.
I mean, we're Sulphur Springs. I mean, sulfur is not a very good thing to be around. Is it toxic, or is it fine? Or I mean, was it healing powers at the time? I mean, there were a lot of those towns in this area that...
It had healing powers, and there were doctors who sent people here to take baths. This was a burger bath house here, and they took the mineral baths, and people would come here and drink that water, believing that it healed them, and it probably helped their stomach a lot, yes. The alkaline water is good water, and it does help. It takes the acid out of your system. And a lot of people now buy Kangen water, which is alkaline water. So, yes, it was for the healing. And we also have a lithium springs over across Butler Creek here.
Lithium spring?
Lithium springs. It's the only one in the United States. And it doesn't have a lot of lithium in it, just a minor amount, but people used to come here, they would drink that water, and they were healed. And people would come in here with jugs, all kinds of jugs, and load that water up and take it home with them and use it and come back for more.
But the spring's still there. That's the...
It is still there. For a while, it wasn't running because there was cracks that happened up in there, especially after they drilled a new well that we have. But they've gone in there recently and cleaned it out, and they're in the process of filling the cracks in. So it's going to run again.
Wow, because I know lithium was used for a time in the maybe it was the 60s or the 70s as a... it was actually in 7-Up, I believe, and it was used to kind of make you feel lighter, and it has some kind of cognitive effects to it.
Yes. We did have a water company here that bottled that water and shipped it out to different places.
Do you remember the name of that company, or is that...
No, I can't tell you the name of it. Just Sulphur Springs Water Company, I think is all it was called.
The Shiloh, tell me about the Shiloh community.
Well, it's a religious community. They sold different kinds of bread. It was a bakery for a while, but it's no longer open. And they had Christian retreats up there. But the man that purchased it lives in Pennsylvania, and he moved all the bakery and everything back to east to Pennsylvania.
So the community doesn't exist anymore here, or is it?
It's up there. There's a few people up there. There's a church up there, but no, they don't have a bakery. They don't really aren't really open anymore.
Where is it precisely?
It's south of this building, right up there across the park. In south, straight up, you can see it. There were 11 hotels in this town at one time, and lots of different businesses, groceries and meat markets and merchandise businesses and so forth.
So what happened? Where did all those hotels go? What happened to
that? Well, there was a series of fires here, and places burned, and the water and light company burned. When it did, there was no more electricity, so businesses had to have electricity, so they moved out.
And residents didn't decide to raise money to...
Well, they did eventually, but when they first got it to going, they only had electric turned on certain times of the day, and that was all. It was turned off at night, at 10 o'clock at night.
Can you imagine that? Would that affect you?
Oh, yes. Ladies could only do their washing and ironing on one day.
One day?
Usually Monday.
Because there wasn't any...
There was no electricity, so they couldn't use a washing machine or an iron. They couldn't iron clothes. So, unless they had a gas iron.
What other stories do you have about Sulphur Springs that are mentioned in your book that you're quite fond of? I mean, you obviously are the historian, or you love history.
Yes, well, in the book we do have the history here of the town history, and we've also got the businesses that were here and pictures of the hotel, the doctors that were here, and we have some of the homes that were here. So there was caves around here that people came and visited. And the Spanish Treasure Cave actually is in Sulphur Springs. Now, the railroad came here, and they had an excursion train that came down from Kansas City on weekends, and there would be 1,000 people that would come here and be in this park. The park at one time had two islands, and they had entertainment on those islands. And the people would come here and drink the water and enjoy the entertainment for the weekend and then go back to Kansas City to their jobs. But it was nice to get away from the city for a while into this small town.
When did the railroad quit doing the excursion train? Did it? Is that when it kind of also, when the fires also kind of?
Well, I don't remember the year that they stopped. They had a restaurant here as well. The Van Noy restaurant was here. And people would get off the train and be able to have a delicious dinner. I'm not sure when the railroads stopped coming here on the excursion trains, but we had a man that named Mr. Eaton that came here and developed the Ozark Colony, and he had a Chautauqua every year, and he made furniture and built it. We have pieces of furniture that he made here in the museum, and he sold it, shipped it out of here.
What's a Chautauqua? What is that?
Well, it's a musical entertainment.
And you kind of explain this in your book.
Yes, it's in the book. And people would come from New York to play in the Chautauqua. And he also taught music. And so they would come here during the summertime and have these different programs.
Do you have a title here specifically? Is it like curator of the museum or historian?
I'm just, I'm the city historian, and I am not the chairman of the commission, but I am on the commission. I am the library director, so I do have a library, and it's up in the old school building.
Do you volunteer all your time out?
Yes, I volunteer all of my time.
Why? Why do you volunteer all your time? You're 82, right? Right.
That's right, but for the benefit of the city, and I would like to promote our city. I would like to see it grow more into a more of a retirement city, and I just love the people here. When I first moved back here, I did not want to move here. My husband, having been raised here, wanted to move back. And I really liked it in Illinois. However, I moved with him, and I decided I'm not going to sit around and whine and gripe about moving. I'm going to be productive, and I'm going to get involved and do what I can do to better the community. So that's what I've done.
Lil Buckley is a member of the Museum Commission for Sulphur Springs, and she recently spoke to Ozarks at Large's John Schlois about that. Lil Buckley is a member of the Museum Commission for Sulphur Springs, and she recently spoke with Ozarks at Large's John Schlois about the town's history. More stories can be found in the book, The History of Sulphur Springs, 1890 to 2012. Copies are $65 each and can be obtained by contacting the museum, which is open from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturdays. The phone number is 298-1201.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 8th of July, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Jean de La Fontaine, born in Chateau Thierry in France, 1621. De La Fontaine, who intended to go into the clergy but found that religion bored him. He was much more interested in the social scene in Paris, took over his father's post as an inspector of forests and waterways, but he had a knack for charming people, especially the rich patrons who supported him, while he wrote his famous fables. The fables of Fontaine, 239 poems, including The Tortoise and the Hare, The City Mouse and the Country Mouse, The Ant and the Grasshopper, The Goose that Laid the Golden Eggs. La Fontaine, who wrote, "It is impossible to please all the world and one's father." It's the birthday of the psychologist Alfred Binet, born in Nice, France, 1857. At a time when psychologists believed that intelligence could be gauged by measuring the head, Binet developed an intelligence test based on tasks such as counting coins or ordering blocks from the smallest to the largest, which became the basis of what became known as the intelligence quotient, the IQ test. And it's the birthday of the novelist Alec Waugh, born in London, 1898, spent most of his adult life living in exotic places and writing about them. His books included Hot Countries and Island in the Sun. Alec Waugh, who had a fairly successful career as a novelist, though he never approached the literary stature of his younger brother, Evelyn Waugh. Here's a poem for today by Ronald Wallace, The Fat of the Land. Gathered in the heavy heat of Indiana, we've come from all over this great country, one big, happy family, back from wherever we've spread ourselves too thin. A cornucopia of cousins and uncles, grandparents and aunts, nieces and nephews, expanding. All day we laze on the oily beach. We eat all the smoke-filled evening, shrimp dip and crackers, Velveeta cheese and beer, handfuls of junk food vanishing. We sit at card tables examining our pudgy hands, piling in hot fudge and double chocolate brownies, strawberry shortcake and cream, as the lard ball children sluice from room to room. Oh, the loveliness of so much loved flesh, the litany of split seams and puffed sleeves, sack dresses and sansabelt slacks, dimpled knees and knuckles, the jiggle of triple chins. Oh, the gladness that only a family understands, our fat smiles dancing as we play our cards right. Our jovial conversation blooms and booms in love's large company as our sweet words ripen and split their skins, mulberry, fabulous, flotation, phlegmatic, plumbaginous. Let our large hearts attack us, our blood run us off the scale. We're huge and whole on this simmering night, battened against the small, skinny futures that must befall all of us, the gray, thin days and the non-caloric dark. The Fat of the Land by Ronald Wallace, from Long for This World, New and Selected Poems, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world, you can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, edited by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The 62nd Annual Opera in the Ozarks runs through July 20th at Inspiration Point near Eureka Springs. This festival of fully produced operas is an educational program for singers pursuing a career in the world of opera. The 2012 productions include A Little Night Music, The Magic Flute, and La Boheme. Tickets and more information are available at opera.org.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Eureka Springs, Bella Vista.
Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Iti Agnihotri Mathulkar. Thank you so much for listening.
Happy Sunday!